And I remember telling me that shortly after you first saw Schindler's List for the first time, you went home and you wrote Steven Spielberg a long letter about how you felt about the experience. Did something similar happen after you saw Lincoln for the first time? And if so, what did you write to him about this piece?
Well, I didn't write him a note in the case of Lincoln. I saw the film fairly early on, after he'd completed a first edit. And I was alone in the room with Mike Kahn. His editor, Steven, just appeared at the very end looking for a reaction. And I think I just stood up and said to him, "Steven, I can't talk to you about this film right now. We'll make it another sometime later." I was just overcome by the power of the film. Obviously, particularly the last scene, which features part of the second inaugural, which is such a ringing and deeply resonant piece for all of us, I think, who've grown up with those very words. It certainly deserved a letter, but I was so shaken that
sure.
I'm afraid we delayed our talks for later. I think he was pleased enough with that reaction. You could see that it was deeply emotional.
Sure. Well, I know exactly how you feel. I mean, I found it, you know, in the best possible sense of this word, disturbing, because watching this guy on screen, you know, I'm not watching an actor acting. I mean, it's Lincoln. I'm not the first one to say this, but it's an uncanny, strange experience.
It's almost a possession. You've heard all the stories about Daniel being unwilling to speak in his normal voice for the entire 3 months of the night and day, 24 hours, entire 3 months of the shooting. I did say to Stephen, after I'd seen the film, that I was reminded last December in one of his talks, President Bill Clinton said something about some physicist in Zurich, I think, sending a particle to Milano, and the particle arrived in Milano before it was sent, illustrating that if they've got their numbers right, there may be a fourth dimension.
Sure.
And I felt that I was sitting with Lincoln in the cabinet meeting in the fourth dimension.
Oh, exactly.
I'd been transported back 125
exactly.
years or whatever. Well, it, as you say, it wasn't acting. It was some kind of a transference.
Yeah.
A fourth dimensional experience.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The film Lincoln received 12 Oscar nominations, one of which for its score by John Williams, who stopped in tonight. We're going to be playing the score for Lincoln and talking about whatever John feels like talking about. John Williams, welcome back to KUSC.
Thank you.
Also very scary is the way the people, the principal people in the film, resemble their historical counterparts.
Yes.
I mean, especially scary was Alexander Stevens,
yes.
the vice president of the Confederacy,
yes.
who in all the pictures looks like this odd doll-like creature, not in a good or pleasant way.
Mm-hmm.
And the makeup, plus, you know, the physical look of Jackie Earle Haley, you know, mm-hmm. also fit very well. I mean, it was for a history buff like me, it was, you know, this strange experience.
A magnificently accomplished casting process, it seems to me. All of them, but Alexander Stevens, who apparently was an unwell man, I think he may have been consumptive, but I also remember reading in Doris Kearns Goodwin's book that Lincoln and other places, that Lincoln admired Stevens as well, and had it said on occasion he's one of the most outstanding speakers he'd ever heard.
Sure. One of the few friends he really made during his one and only trip to Congress for 2 years.
Amazing.
He and Stevens became good
yes.
friends.
It may have been a serendipitous thing through and through. All of the casting seemed to be so convincing. The cabinet members, the lookalikes, and fabulous performances by a team of actors that I think all rose to bring their best game to this project. I haven't met very many of them, but I admire all of them. I did see Sally Fields recently, who did, I think, such a beautiful job, and I was surprised. I just said to her, "Sally, I wonder, where did you go?" She was a sliver of a little girl, you know. And she gained 30 pounds to be able to fit into Mary Todd's clothing and then lost the weight back. They were all quite fabulous, Tommy Lee Jones, and delivering those fantastic collection of words by Tony Kushner.
Yeah.
And the readings of them all. I spoke to Tony about this also, and he said, oh, yes, the way it was all read was so brilliant, so true. Quite an experience, coming initially from Doris Kearns Goodwin, as we know, who I think I met her in 1999. We were working on the Millennium Celebration for Washington, which she participated in, and I believe that is when Stephen met her, when she was writing the Team of Rivals. And they had agreed somehow to share the work and that Stephen would be allowed to produce this film. I understand that Doris is very happy about the result and happy with what Tony Kushner has written.
Yeah. She'd been hard to please, had she not been. I mean, it's, yeah, it just nails it. Given the nature of the picture itself, I think it's one of your most quiet scores. Not that there aren't very big moments, but it's a very, very quiet, chamber-like piece for much of the score.
Its function, of course, Jim, is to provide accompaniment, in many cases, to very dense dialogue. And the dynamics of all of the sound and the accompanying music and so on will be shaped by those requirements, of course. I want to say that when we're listening to the music, we're listening to members of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra play. Even some of these very delicate, quiet passages that require so much control, and they're delivered by the players in Chicago with a tremendous artistry in every case. And it may be interesting to your listeners to know, and they may wonder why the Chicago Symphony is performing on this film soundtrack. The reason really is that for 10 or 12 years now or so, I've been conducting fairly regularly in Chicago and know the orchestra well and like them very much. And every time I came back from Chicago, I would say to Steven Spielberg, that is a fabulous orchestra. Of course, everybody knows this, but I'm enthused at the end of each appearance that I've had to him. And so when the question of where we should record the music for Lincoln arose, Stephen said, why don't we just do it in Chicago? It's the land of Lincoln, Illinois, the center of the country, and a great orchestra. Why not do it there? And I think the thing that clinched the deal in his mind was that we were told that Illinois was the first state to ratify the 13th Amendment. And therefore, it might be certainly an honor that the citizens of Illinois might want to accept. And so we rang up the orchestra, and they readily agreed to do it. And even though the score is in many ways intimate and quiet and accompanimental in its character, still the great artistry of the orchestra and the players within it, I think, is apparent. We recorded in Symphony Hall in Chicago, and it's a beautiful acoustic there also, which permeates the face of the sound.
You know, the first professional orchestra I ever saw as a kid, first concert I ever saw, Fritz Reiner conducting the Chicago Symphony. And is it any wonder I'm the way I am? Freedom. And for someone who hasn't seen Lincoln yet, it's not quite the way it appears in the film. And I thought that was one of the most electrifying moments when, and again, I don't want to spoil the surprise, but here are a bunch of politicians, for reasons of their own, mostly Republican politicians, singing the battle cry of freedom. And it's not, you know, the most elegantly sung thing, but it doesn't have to be. And it suddenly morphs into the Chicago Symphony Chorus.
Yes.
Every single, just talking about it, every single hair on both forearms snapped to attention. It's a great, great moment.
It's a wonderful moment, really. And yes, challenging, actually, to deal with these raw recorded tracks of the congressmen, which were not examples of Robert Shaw's idea of intonation and ensemble, but exactly right for what it needed to be. and to morph from the all-male Congress as it then was to an all-male, increasingly professional sound, and adding the women in the orchestras we got into the street scene gradually and smoothly. I hope we accomplished it. I think it's there. Actually, the end of it is very rousing sonically. The brass in Chicago is particularly fabulous. And chorus is very fine. The one regret I had about that sequence, Jim, is that it was too short. I wanted to go on, play, and sing more. They sounded so magnificently good in the hall.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, along with being wonderfully intimate and almost chamberlike, I can't really think, with the possible exception of Saving Private Ryan, of a more intensely American score that you've ever written. Again, and this is the tough thing to do, I would think. It's a period piece. It's the 19th century. And to not make it seem like a quaint period piece. I mean, the harmonies, there weren't, you know, many of those big open fifths being written in the late 19th century. But so much of the melodic content of the score not only has the quality of folk music, you listen to it for the first time, you have the uncanny sense you know this music. You've never heard it before, mm-hmm. but it is so folk-like.
Mm-hmm. The particular melodious quality in American music is something that we would, I suppose, need a very fine musicologist to take us through the history of. What is the real groundstone of American melody? Is it, the stone is in New England, certainly. And it's certainly in the Appalachia. And when I was in Boston, Jim, conducting the Pollock, I still conduct there for over 30 years, but in my 14 years as music director in Boston, we played as much American music as we could. And I began with an interest in early symphonic American music, meaning people like Burlingame Hill and George Chadwick, whose short pieces we played fairly frequently, and Arthur Foote's and Beautiful Things and others. And this is the generation of American composers who somehow found their melodic inspiration in this American bedrock source of melody, coming, I suppose, from liturgical sources and hymn books and the rest of it. A generation that preceded Roy Harris and Aaron Copland, Bernstein, and later ones. So this question of Americanism in music has certainly been part of my whole musical life. This was an opportunity to think about sources. And working backwards at the end of the film to accompany the second inaugural, I felt a particular challenge and heavy responsibility to find something that was worthy of the moment, of worthy to accompany some of the greatest words ever written in our American language. And I could never find anything in the hymn book I thought that was exactly right. I mean, the Lutheran hymn book, I think, has 660 items in it. I don't know if there's a definitive American hymn book, but I'm sure there is one with hundreds of items. Maybe they're shared with European sources. Texts are all liturgical and very religious. And the harmonic style is of a 19th century Christian hymnal style that we know very well. But I somehow didn't feel that ever could be exactly right with this religious overtones that almost all of these hymns have. And that I felt I was better off arranging a series intervallically and harmonically that would shape in the time that I had in the right way. And so I ended up doing what I usually do, writing my own tunes and shaping them to the film and reshaping them freely in a way that perhaps I wouldn't feel comfortable doing something from the canon. I think it's a process, at least for me, living with American music my entire life, it's a natural thing. I don't have to think very much about this. Our music is so rich. It's nothing to do with Lincoln at all, but the spiritual choral repertoire that we have from the African-American area of our music and jazz and all of that, something I know and love well all my life. And I have always enjoyed performing, especially in Boston, those earlier composers. And trying to work the wonder and answer the question, what these Americanisms that we hear, what do they really consist of, other than the simple intervallic and harmonic analysis that we might do? It's an elusive spiritual thing, I suppose, that is as complicated as the difference between the speech that we use now and the inflection that we might have used in 1860, whenever period we look at. Fascinating things. and a wonderful opportunity for me and Lincoln to do the best I could to get things just right, to accompany these fabulous speakers with wonderful voices, speaking in probably largely 20th century inflections, but we accept them as being authentic. I think Daniel Day-Lewis apparently has done a very believable impression of what Lincoln must have sounded like. We read that Lincoln had a reedy, high, penetrating voice, good thing, and Daniel was able to replicate this. It's a big question, Americanism in music, that's been with me a very, very long time, and I so enjoyed making this effort, and I hope it's remotely worthy of the writing and the performing in the piece.
The music associated with what the film calls the Skulky Men. You had a little help.
Well, there's some banjo that you will hear. It's played by a gentleman called Taylor from North Carolina. I found it on a recording and was able to take it off, and we accompanied it with some of our own players, and we were able to shape it into the cues that we needed. I think it's used twice. A brilliant piece of initial picking, which we then enhanced electronically and instrumentally with some of our own players. Incidentally, this work was not done in Chicago. We did that here in studio in Los Angeles.
Yeah, and there are, you know, for such a deeply serious subject as this, it's a very funny movie. I mean, there are some wonderfully hilarious moments, some unintentional, some, for instance, when they're talking about, well, if we enfranchise these people, what's next? Women?
Yes.
And the reaction of that in the entire house. I mean, it's one of the things that crossed all political lines. Mm-hmm. Democrats and Republicans both stood up and did what they did.
Yes. Humor is wonderful. Apparently, Lincoln's own personal countrified humor was something that when applied, sometimes would enrage his serious colleagues, and that was also clear. But I think it, like humor for all of us, it can be a saving therapy when we take ourselves too seriously or we succumb to pretensions or sanctimony, which I don't think Lincoln ever seemed to be doing. He was a humorous man, apparently, and I think that the stories that were told were genuine ones. I'm not sure Tony researched them. I'm sure they've done carefully. But I didn't particularly think of it as a humorous film, but so appreciated the humor in it and the fact that it shows the healing function of humor. It may be something that needs to be close to compromise for that to be affected.
Sure. And, of course, what the film also underscores is how touch and go the passage of the 13th Amendment was.
Yes.
I mean, it was not a foregone conclusion.
No.
That at the end of the Civil War, slavery was going to end in America. That was not by any means a foregone conclusion.
What struck me, Jim, was that perhaps unlike you, all I'd been taught in school was that the Emancipation Proclamation had freed the slaves. That's what I knew. And reading and working on the film and reading Doris's book, of course, made me understand that the Emancipation Proclamation itself would have been shown to be illegal by the courts if the war had ended without the constitutional amendment, that it was a War Powers Act executed by the president that almost certainly would have been shown to be illegal. And its very existence and the fact that it could be challenged is the very thing that made the 13th Amendment an absolute necessity before the war could be justifiably ended. I have to confess, this was news to me, and a fine education, I think. Just on the point that I think American audiences, whatever our levels of information about the 19th century Civil War and his presidency, all of us will be enriched by seeing the film, I think, more than once. If I may, I'll just remind your audience that you told me a few minutes ago before our chat that you'd seen the movie 5 times. I think that's fantastic, actually, because once really isn't enough. Some writer has said you should take the children to the film, let them sit there and fidget, but then insist that they come back and see it again and again. we can't first time identify every senator and every congressman completely. It'll take a little while to work some of that out, whatever your background might be. But it's all carefully done there and well organized by Tony Kushner. And it is an entertaining film, but it is, even more importantly, an edifying film, making it something of extreme historical value, I think.
Oh. Well, as a matter of fact, this Saturday evening at 8 o'clock at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion, you're going to be conducting some music from Lincoln, among other things.
Right. I look forward to this very much, Jim. It is the YMF Orchestra. It's their annual gala. The foundation has done for, I don't know how many, 60 years, I guess, now. And we'll be at the Chandler Pavilion. I'll conduct a concert of my music. Bing Wang will be a soloist. You know Bing, who's the associate concertmaster of the Philharmonic, of Los Angeles Philharmonic. I conducted these young people last year, also not in a complete concert, but enjoyed it so much. It's one of the exciting things that's happening in American music education, and so much is happening. You and I talked earlier about American music, and I hate to end the conversation without mentioning something about Tanglewood and Serge Koussevitzky, who did so much for American music. When you read about his early tenure in Boston and the American composers and the American music that he commissioned, presented, encouraged, mentored, and so on. And that Tanglewood is continuing his great educational legacy at the highest level here in our country, I think. And YMF here on the West Coast, and there are other fine groups also, doing equally excellent work, I think. We can be so proud of our young musicians, these youngsters. They sound like fabulous symphony orchestras, and they are that. And it's a part of the cultural currency of our country that I think we don't trumpet loudly and frequently and often enough.
Yeah, unfortunately. Unfortunately. And, you know, we happen to live in a city which, you know, I've said this so many times that, you know, I hardly need to say it again. I mean, the greatest musicians on earth live here. Because they have no other choice. If they weren't, they couldn't do what they do.
Yeah, true, true, very true. Los Angeles has been, since way back now, a result of a unique situation. When you think that Schoenberg and Stravinsky both were local residents and that Rachmaninoff lived here and that the film industry has produced so much unforgettable music played by great musicians, initially coming from Europe, many as a result of the war. We have a great history. It was almost the second Vienna for a while here with the presence of the two greatest giants of the last century living here. Points of great pride for all of us here in Southern California.
Absolutely. Absolutely. As are you, sir. And, you know, I'm always reminded of the thing that the correspondent of the London Morning Chronicle said. He was writing about one of those concerts that Haydn presented at the Hanover Square Rooms. And he summed it all up by saying, this wonderful man never disappoints us. And I think that sort of summarizes you in the sense that we always expect some of the greatest film music ever written from your scores. And that's what we always get, including in the most recent one, I have to say.
Well, Jim, thank you very much. It's very high praise from a gentleman. Incidentally, I love coming to speak to you on our occasional visits because whenever I'm with you, I always seem to learn something.
Well, John,
thanks to you for what you do. It's work done at the highest level.
Oh, appreciate it.
Appreciate it.